The Tom Woods Show, episode 2227.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. I'm giving away three free courses from my Liberty Classroom. One of them is ex-Marxist Michael Rechtenwald teaching you about critical theory so you can understand leftism and fight it better, as well as our course on how Alexander Hamilton screwed up America and the history of the conservative and libertarian movements. Check it out at 3freecourses.com. Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. Today, I'm going to share with you rather an interesting conversation I had on Liberty Lockdown, the podcast hosted by Clint Russell. So without further ado, because it is rather a long conversation, I introduce you to Tom Woods talking to Clint Russell. Here we go.
It's finally here. We have the great Tom Woods with us today. I am so happy. We can finally take those allowable opinions and throw them on the ground, and the silky smooth words of Tom Woods will be the only sound. It's about damn time. Goodness gracious, I'm excited. And without further ado, the man of the hour, the legend himself, the great Thomas E. Woods. Welcome in.
Hey, Clint.
I'm very over the top. I apologize.
That's okay. I got to do something about, I don't do that much video. I'm going to be doing more video now. I got to do something about the sunlight coming in through this window because it washes me out. So I'm trying to block it with my head, but that means I'm too close to the camera like Walter Block always is in his videos. So I don't know quite what to do.
If you think you're getting wiped out by the backlight, check out my problem here. Right?
Well, true. But at least you have a view to look at.
That's true. So what I wanted to talk to you about, or I wanted to start with, I listened to your great episode of The Tom Woods Show. If you guys haven't listened to it, you had on, oh my God, I'm blanking on his name.
I'll remember the name. Tell me the topic.
Yeah, Barnes Law. Robert Barnes.
Oh yeah, Robert Barnes, yeah.
I forgot his first name for a second. And I've been put in a libertarian quandary here where obviously I've been very much so in defense of both Kanye West and Alex Jones. But what I've started to reflect on, which I had never really considered before, and I thought you would be a perfect guest to ask about this because I've, from my vantage point, I've witnessed some slander, some libel against you.
Yep.
So are slander and libel laws in conflict with libertarianism?
Well, strictly speaking, I'm sure you're familiar with Rothbard's analysis of this, which is that your reputation is really what other people think about you. And so it's ideas in other people's brains, but you don't own other people's brains. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, you don't own your reputation. Now, if you have really, really strong libel and slander laws, so strong that, let's say, every single time an untruth is uttered, the person is uttering it is immediately penalized, or let's say 90% of the time, somebody who utters an untruth about you is penalized, then you would pretty much assume that pretty much every major accusation about somebody must be true.
Mm.
But if you don't have these laws, then you're much, much more likely to say, well, gee, that's a pretty awful thing to say. They're really going to have to justify that. I'm not sure if that's true or not. You're much, much more likely to be skeptical about things that people say about others. So that's one thing. But then also, it's
kind of like that,
where it can ultimately lead. Even if it gives you a little bit of short-term satisfaction when used against certain people, it's going to tend to be used against who? Against enemies of the regime. That's right. Always. It'll always be used that way. That's how it's going to be used. And then it becomes intentional infliction of emotional distress, which is a fake. That's a fake crime. That's not a real thing. I mean, anything you say and do, if I call you a name, maybe that inflicts emotional distress on you, but that's not aggression.
I get 100 tweets a day that inflict emotional distress on me.
Exactly. And that's why we use the word aggression. There was a brief period where some wishy-washy libertarians wanted to talk instead of non-aggression. They want to talk non-harm. But harm is a weasel word.
Right.
Because I could harm you by outcompeting you in the marketplace. Should I be penalized for that? I could harm you by insulting you. I could harm you by being late all the time. Should I be punished or put in prison for any of these things? So I think it's best to just stick with non-aggression. It is, you know, it's not an ideal solution, but the problem is all the alternatives are bad also. Now, it's possible to imagine that, let's say, in an ANCAP society, maybe there's some big, big, voluntarily agreed to area where there are certain rules in there. Maybe in this particular settlement, there's a rule that if you're going to accuse somebody of some horrible crime. If you don't have any evidence, then we're going to penalize you for that. You know, well, then you voluntarily agreed to that. Mm-hmm. But I think the default is, I mean, look at half the country thinks Hillary Clinton's a murderer. The other half thinks Donald Trump's a murderer. It goes with the territory. They have to live with it.
And they're both right. Yeah, it's interesting.
Truth because, is a defense after all, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting because I was just in the gym a second ago. And by the way, my air conditioning is out. For the audience's sake, I would have dressed more appropriately for the Great Tom Woods, but I did not have a choice.
My air conditioning, I am freezing in here. So that's why.
Rub it in, Tom.
If that makes you feel any better, I'm very
By the transitive properties of your air conditioning, I feel much better. So I was in the gym a minute ago and I was just thinking about it. And I was like, it almost makes me start to question like a hitman. Because, I mean, obviously the accusation against Alex Jones was way over the top and completely far-fetched. And basically they were saying that he sicked his audience on these poor parents that were grieving over the death of their children. And like, you know, God bless them. I'm sure that was not fun. But at the same time, like I am of the belief that it is ultimately the person who actually goes out and harasses these parents that is guilty of something, you know, depending on the extent of the harassment. And if it gets so severe that these people have to move, well, then, you know, they should probably take it up with the people that are doing the harassing, not necessarily the guy who's verbally just discussing in broad-based. For those that aren't familiar, Alex didn't give out addresses. I don't even think he gave out the majority of their names, even though most of them were, were publicly known. So it's interesting because then I started thinking, I'm like, well, if you tell someone to go kill someone, should you be held culpable and to what extent? And is it actually equal in the extent? Or is the murderer, you know, in fact, the only person that should be held liable? And I had never really considered it. I'd always just kind of like taken, well, yeah, if you tell someone to go kill someone and they do it, that should probably be criminal. But at the same time, now I'm like, I don't know. I don't know if I actually believe that.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure either. I mean, there's also that line between a threat and actually carrying out the threat.
Sure.
So if I come at you with a knife and I'm approaching you menacingly, I don't think it would be much defense on my part if you, let's say, kick me in the head, anticipating that I was going to stab you with the knife. I don't think it would be much defense for me to say, what? I was just showing you my new knife. I don't know why you reacted the way you did. So in other words, there are cases where the line is a little bit fuzzy. And this is a case where you have to use the old legal principle of what would a reasonable person do in that situation? And a reasonable person in that kind of situation would assume he's about to be assaulted. And so a reasonable person could therefore be expected to defend himself in anticipation of a coming attack. Mm-hmm. So something like this, well, I think you'd have to look at it on a case-by-case basis. If you were dealing with a person, let's say, who was very, very suggestible because of some mental defect, let's say had the mentality of a 7-year-old child but was 35, and you said, go kill that person, I think that would be much graver than if I said to you, go kill that person, you're not going to do it. I mean, somebody could tell you all day long to go kill somebody and you would never even consider it.
Right.
So I am inclined to leave it with who actually landed the blow. Because maybe you could sit around and fantasize all day about robbing banks. But if you don't actually rob the bank, or if I tell you, go rob that bank, and then you rob it, I don't know, like, I'm the one who sat here and did nothing. You know, so just for being the idea man, I don't know. I mean, it seems like if that's what floats people's boats, they ought to be able to fantasize about robbing banks. And,
well,
I don't know. I think the bank robber is the one you should act on.
Yeah, no, I tend to as well. And I think only if like there's a contract or money changes hands and you're actually ordering a hitman to go.
Right, then it's totally different.
Then it's really quite
because
clear.
Because people say crazy things all day long. And then we have to get it.
You ever ridden a public bus? My God.
Yeah, exactly. And then, so then what? The law has to adjudicate how seriously did the person mean the thing he said? Come on.
Right. No, it does get very, very gray area. And the reason I'm asking about all this, I did an episode about a week ago where I broke down and argued against someone who I had liked and I still like, but I did lose a little bit of respect for him, was Jacob Hornberger, who was the Mises Caucus endorsed nominee or whatever or he attempted to be the Libertarian Party candidate in the last election cycle. He wrote an article saying Alex Jones got what he deserved. And I found that quite appalling. You know, it's just, I think that the disconnect here, at least the one that I view, is that it seems that there are some people that don't understand exactly what danger we are in as being political dissidents in this particular period in time. I'm not saying that, you know, this is always the case. I think throughout the first 20 plus years of my life, it wasn't necessarily the case. But at this point, it seems like such a grave danger to be endorsing any sort of state apparatus that allows our speech to be curtailed. Seems like a terribly dangerous precedent to allow for, much less endorse or verbally support. Where do you fall on this?
Well, I mean, I like Barnes on this. So tomwoods.com/2219. I don't know the episode numbers of all my shows, but I've been sending that link out a lot, so I memorized it. Sure. That's where I talked to Barnes about Alex Jones. Well, for instance, in order to reach this crazy $965 million verdict, they had to, because typically, I mean, we hear all these defamation cases, $250 million defamation case. We think that it's just commonplace for there to be these nine-figure decisions made, but not at all. The average such decision is under $100,000.
Right.
So this is wildly out of scale. But in order to reach that, they had to get him not so much with defamation, but on faulty consumer product grounds. So they were using a law that you use if you sell a faulty consumer product to people. But of course, Alex Jones was not selling any product, and the case has nothing to do with the sale of products. But that was a convenient way because under those laws, the decisions can be very high. So they just used it. Now, why would you, as a lawyer, look at that and say, yeah, this causes me no pause whatsoever. He got what he deserved. Really? Mm-hmm. So there's that. Then the fact that one of the people who got $90 million in this, $90 million, was an FBI agent who worked on the case, didn't know any of the families. No Sandy Hook family.
Oh,
but
my God.
He worked on the case and, you know, Alex Jones said something about him. And so $90 million. Look, you know, I say a lot of nasty things about FBI people, right?
This is
crazy. The FBI guy gets
made a career out of it.
Dollars. And not to mention, at least in one of the trials, the jury pool was questioned on whether they were willing to consider very, very high payouts as a prerequisite for being on the jury. They had to agree that $10 million per person was not unreasonable. Well, now you're hearing that, I don't know if you saw this headline the other day, but now they're talking about, wait a minute, maybe we should go back and think about this again, because there is a formula by which we could reach $2.7 trillion, which is more than the GDPs of most countries of the world. Now, by the way, bear in mind, what is the family of the actual shooter paying, right? I mean,
right.
Alex Jones didn't actually shoot anybody, right? He didn't
right.
shoot anybody. And they want to ultimately go for $2.7 trillion. Now, you don't dare say anything bad about these parents now, right? Nobody dares say anything bad about these parents now. So I won't say anything bad about them. I will say it is absolutely normal and not ghoulish at all to exploit the deaths of your children to try to wring $2.7 trillion out of somebody. That is perfectly normal and very much to be praised.
Yes, I love the framing on that. Well played. Yeah, I mean, I tweeted it out also in a kind of obfuscated fashion where I didn't say anybody's name and I just kind of used the timing of the tweet for everyone to know what I was talking about. But I could not agree more. It's a totally reasonable ask. Everybody who is wronged verbally by anyone absolutely deserves the GDP of France.
Yeah.
Couldn't agree more. Yeah, I mean, it's just very concerning to me because, you know, Jacob Hornberger is obviously well-read. I'm sure he's read Rothbard. Like, it was perplexing to me that he could come to that conclusion, particularly given that he is an attorney. It's fascinating. But I don't really want to harp on that too much. I did want to ask you about, you know, and granted, I am a fan of Alex Jones. I'll put my cards on the table. And I think that much of his work and his research has been high quality over the years. And obviously, much of it has been not high quality and pretty bad. But I've always appreciated anybody as someone who's a political dissident, who's seeking truth. And we are awash in lies in a way that I don't think I ever imagined possible at this point in particular, especially after the past 2 years. I can't believe that anyone wouldn't want more people digging, more people that are trying to tell the truth. And I feel like Alex has done that. But anyways, my read of this and putting on my tinfoil hat to go along with my defense of Alex Jones is that this is a broader attack against people like you and I. And I know I'm personalizing this and perhaps unnecessarily so, but I can't help but feel as if they are trying to make the bill for dissident thought and dissident speech so high that if it doesn't ultimately kill third rail political commentators, it scares them into submission or chills their speech adequately that we become less of a threat. Am I reading too much into this, or do you get that vibe as well?
Yeah, well, of course, that's a vibe I get. And it's funny, of course, all the fashionable libertarians who are so tiresome, I try to ignore them the best I can, which since they're all pygmies and none of them do anything, it's not hard to ignore them. But all these people, you know, they of course need to broadcast to make sure the New York Times understands that they do not support Alex Jones, right? They have to make sure. The New York Times doesn't even know they exist, right? But they've got to make sure Wolf Blitzer knows that we're not like that Woods, you know, we're not like Clint Russell, you know? Right. So that irritates me that they pretend that there's nothing more to see here than just one simple case or one particular individual. But of course there is. I mean, when we saw Alex Jones get deplatformed from several places pretty much simultaneously,
right?
I was very concerned about that, even as somebody who, when I say I'm not an Alex Jones fan, I'm not an Alex Jones opponent. I to be perfectly honest with you, I don't listen to anybody. Oh, I listen to Dave once in a while, but I really don't listen to anybody. I feel like when I'm off the job, I'm off the job. Like a plumber doesn't listen to plumbing podcasts. Like I want to do other things. I listen to podcasts on a completely different topic. But anyway, I have nothing against the guy. You know, I don't see any reason to have anything against him. And so when he got deplatformed, I did think that was something to be concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, we were also told, oh, it's just this one person because he's so wildly unreasonable and you don't have anything to worry about because you're not wildly unreasonable. And then suddenly lots of reasonable people, so-called, found themselves getting deplatformed, who were telling unambiguous truths,
mm-hmm.
suddenly started getting deplatformed. And then the excuse was, well, it's the free market and these companies can do what they want. Then we find out that the federal government is actually naming people. They actually say to Twitter, you know, we don't like Alex Berenson. You know, they actually say, and then at this point, then they don't really quite know what to say, but they really don't want to be on the side of Alex Berenson. They don't want to be on the side against Dr. Fauci. It is all about respectability for these people. And respectability, craving of respectability, is the worst possible motivator. It leads you down all kinds of treacherous alleys. So the point is, Alex Jones got deplatformed. The same people who say today that this case is unique because of his unique wickedness were saying that about his deplatforming. Mm-hmm. And then we saw everybody else having these problems. I mean, I did a couple of episodes of the Tom Woods Show recently that I didn't put up on YouTube because I knew there'd be, what's the point? They're going to be taken down. I'm going to get a strike against my channel. So I have to put them up on Odyssey. I think I'm on Rumble. My tech people do this for me. I like Odyssey, or just, you know, through the usual podcast apps. Because as you know, podcasting has been, at least up to now, for the most part, with very, very few exceptions, a channel through which unfiltered ideas can still pass. And so I can still do that. You know, so I myself, in fact, I was hanging by a thread on my YouTube channel for several months. I don't reuse my YouTube channel as much as I might, but still I would prefer to have it because I can reach some people that way. So I don't have this sanguine view that we shouldn't worry about it. It's just a one-time, one-off thing because of his unique wickedness. You know, look, if the president of the United States can't get on Twitter, you know, then I think there's a concern for you and me.
Right. Well, and I think it was less than a year between the Alex Jones mass banning and Trump being banned. It's like the slippery slope is not just real, but it's rapid.
Remember when people used to criticize us for talking about the slippery slope? And
oh, yeah.
It's all just a bunch of hysteria and right-wing paranoia and all that. The slippery slope argument turns out to be consistently reliably correct.
It's batting better than Tony Gwynn at this point. I mean, it's incredible. No, I'm serious. It's so concerning that people can still kind of, I don't know, compartmentalize the treatment of Alex Jones and not see the obvious extrapolation into our arena in particular. And the fact that Alex Berenson, a guy who was banned, even though he was telling the truth, and then obviously got his account back because he sued because the CDC was actually directing Twitter on what their policies should be. And then he turns around and he says, fuck Alex Jones. I hope his entire career is ruined. And it's like,
yeah,
can you not connect these dots, folks? Like, just because you're saying something that's unpopular, even if what you're saying was true, which in Alex Berenson's case, it was true. Alex has said some true things too. Do you think he was actually banned because of what he was saying about the Sandy Hook parents? Or do you think it was because he was in staunch opposition to Iraq won, Afghanistan invasion, all this other stuff. The fact that he also questioned the narratives on the elections and ultimately brought many of his audience members to the Capitol on January 6th. I mean, that's really, in my view, that's really why he is viewed as such a threat. And ultimately, he is kind of the ringleader of people who are in direct opposition to the narrative, whatever that narrative is, and it's constantly evolving. I love those people, and I will always stand in defense of those people. In fact, I've seen many anti-war socialists who obviously I disagree with on a hell of a lot that have been banned recently, and I am terribly in opposition to that as well. Like, we need to stand together, particularly with the incoming potential of World War III, and now they're labeling, you know, American and French and European reporters who are talking about kind of the Russian argument as to what led to this war, what's transpiring currently, and they're labeling them as Russian affiliated media on Twitter. You can see it right now. It's absolutely evil. And I just really am disappointed that there isn't more unanimity when it comes to the opposition.
Let me say something about Berenson. I want to give him his due, first of all, because in terms of the things that he's done, he has done a lot of good things, and he did expose a lot of truths, and he got some things right before I did, that's for sure. And I wasn't sure he was right. Turns out he was right.
He's not right
on everything. And in particular, from the beginning, he seems to have had this view that if he could just keep his distance from certain right-wing quarters, then he might be taken seriously,
right,
you know, as one of the serious people.
He's still seeking respect. Yeah.
And this was such a case of self-delusion. And yet it's still going on. He still can't help himself. He's still got to say, hey, I'm not like that guy over there, as if that's the urgent matter before us right now.
Right.
Also the way he treats people who disagree. There are obviously people of goodwill who are talking about certain treatments for COVID-19, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
Obviously people of goodwill. And he mocks and ridicules them. Instead of saying, look, I know your heart's in the right place. We all want to find a good treatment. You're just going to have to show me better evidence for this one. That's how you address people who are 85% on your side, right? That's how you address them. You don't dismiss them in front of the whole world, hoping that the world will say, oh, what a reasonable man Alex Berenson turns out to be. Did that happen at all? Did anyone ever say that? Did they say, well, he really treated Robert Malone like an SOB, so I bet you Alex Berenson's a great guy. Didn't work out for him.
No, it did not. It definitely didn't. And I think that now that we've been, you, I, Dave, Berenson, all these other people have been proven correct on our assessment about COVID-19, the treatments, the protocols, the mandates, the lockdowns, everything. We have, again, batted better than Tony Gwynn on this stuff. Sorry, I keep bringing it up because my Padres just got knocked out of the freaking playoffs. It's breaking my heart.
Sorry.
But I wanted to ask you a little bit about, kind of in hindsight, if you have gone down the Alex Jones path in analyzing why we were treated the way we were, and perhaps what were some ulterior motives for their goals moving forward. I'm asking for a little conspiracy theorizing from you, but I have my own ideas. I don't have any answers here, so I'll preface it by saying I don't know exactly, but I have some theories. Have you given any thought to that?
Well, I've started to, and I have to say that this is an area where, regardless of what Alex Jones's answers are, he's been asking a question that, look, I was slow to ask. I'll be honest and answer that. I was slow to ask it, which is, who the hell is running things?
Right.
That's basically what he's been asking. Mm-hmm. Who is actually running things? Why is there so much continuity in the United States, for example, from one presidential administration to another? Who the hell is actually running things?
Right.
And there are a lot of different possible answers. Now, of course, these days, there's a lot of attention being given to the so-called World Economic Forum, which I bet most of us a few years ago had never even heard of.
No, exactly.
It wasn't even on the radar. Now, everybody wants to know about it, which I assume is not the way they like it.
No.
I assume they like to be more in the background, like the Federal Reserve. And now we're watching them, too. But in terms of trying to figure out exactly who and how and the mechanisms they're using, I know there are some people out there who feel like they've got it all figured out and they have the whole flow chart figured out. Let's be honest. No one can have that level of information. But we can have very informed hunches. And I mean, look, I will say about the WEF, they have this program whereby they try to raise up young leaders and place them in regimes around the world. I mean, that's not particularly subtle. No, I'm not doing that.
They brag about it. They brag about it on video. And yes, we ought to be doing that. Absolutely.
I mean, if only as a defense mechanism against what they're doing.
Exactly. Yeah, it's the World Economic Forum, Young Global Leaders. You can look at
that. That's what it is. Young Global Leaders, right. And, you know, and meanwhile, we're all sitting back repeating libertarian slogans like, I just want to be left alone.
Right.
Well, okay, then I guess Klaus Schwab won't try to ruin your life then. If you put that little sign on your door, he passes you over.
Okay. Yeah. Good luck.
I'm still at the very beginnings of trying to make sense of all this. And I am grateful to my friends who finally said to me, something's fishy. Right?
Yeah.
Something is fishy here. And then the other thing that I've been really, really slow on, because sometimes people ask me, have you changed your mind on anything over the years? And well, sure I have. I have changed my mind on some things. I mean, maybe, I don't know if you know this, but I was a neocon a very long time ago.
Sure.
Because it was before the internet, and neocon and left liberal were the only choices that I knew of. So I guess I'm a neocon. I didn't even know the word neocon, but I look back at my opinions and they were pretty neocon. But
that was 40 years ago. I'll forgive it.
Yeah, thank you. I think the statute of limitations for that offense has expired. But so I changed my mind on foreign policy, which a lot of people who came into the Ron Paul movement say that they did. I had already changed it a long time before that, but a lot of people say they changed their mind on that. Well, one thing I've sort of begun to change my mind on, and it took 2020 and being bashed over the head with how corrupt the medical establishment is, how the best thing you can say about most of it is the complete lack of curiosity among most people involved in it. Not all. We all know some honorable people, some good doctors, some truth tellers, but there's just no curiosity. The central authority says I should prescribe this, then I guess all I need to hear. And then, there's this paper which has 5,000 flaws, would never be allowed to pass peer review in any other discipline. That's all I need. I was very slow to be on the ball with regard to so-called big pharma. And I even thought, and I just said this on an episode of my show, I even thought that people who harped on this probably had like a screw loose or something. I mean, don't they understand all the benefits of modern medicine? I mean, I had the same kind of dumb guy, obvious arguments that I can't stand when they're used against me. Don't you know we need to social distance and flatten the curve? Well, yeah, I think I do because I've heard that 100 billion times, you midwit. Why are you repeating that to me? And yet I'm just repeating back at these people as if they have no response, all these sorts of things. And now you pull the curtain back. And it's a mess. It is just a train wreck.
Hey, folks, quick message from Ole Woods here. If you are looking to add Bitcoin to your retirement account and thinking about the long haul, then the best and easiest way to do that is with BitTrust IRA. BitTrust IRA helps you seamlessly and securely add cryptocurrency to your portfolio. It stores your private keys in nuclear bunkers with military-grade encryption. They have a 24/7 trading platform with no minimum investments and unlimited trades, plus a team to help guide you along the way if you have any questions. They also offer the lowest trading fees in the industry. I've often said that if Bitcoin is ever to gain more widespread acceptance, it's going to have to be more user-friendly, and BitTrust IRA could not be easier to use. So go to bittrustira.com/woods today to learn more. And for a limited time, BitTrust IRA is waiving the sign-up fee for Tom Woods Show listeners, a $50 value. That's bittrustira.com/woods, bittrustira.com/woods.
What I'm appreciative of is that I think that when you start to see crisis in what appears to be on the surface a functioning system, it kind of shows how deep the rot really is. And I think that that's beneficial if you're someone like us who's kind of a, you know, obviously I advocate on behalf of the Libertarian Party and third parties more broadly and libertarianism specifically. And I'm just so, in hindsight, I'm very grateful that, you know, my message is much more appealing to people who have been woken up because of the abuses that they suffered, because they lost their jobs. I'm not grateful for their treatment. I obviously wish it hadn't occurred, but I'm just saying I see it as a tremendous opportunity. I mean, the fact that my show has had so much success is because I named it Liberty Lockdown and I started in May 2020, 2 months into lockdowns. Like, I was staunchly opposed and I was covering every step of the way as I listened to your show. You were doing the same. And it's like, this was the greatest red pilling of our lifetimes. What's fascinating to me is like they were able to transition effortlessly from the COVID PSYOP directly into the Ukraine-Russia World War III PSYOP. And still, unfortunately, the red pilling doesn't transfer to the newest PSYOP, in my estimation.
Sometimes it does.
Okay.
If it's red enough, then it's, you know, because I had this great guy from the FLCCC. It's the Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance. Mm-hmm. Dr. Pierre Corey. I had him on a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, he's great.
And toward the end, now he's a doctor and that's what he focuses on. He's not super duper political or anything, or he wasn't before.
Sure.
And he said that now his attitude is, now that he's seen, we had this kind of interesting meeting of the minds toward the end of the episode, because he's seen how the New York Times treats topics he knows about. Mm. And he says, well, wait a minute, geez, if they're this stupid on things I know about, how bad have they been on things I don't know anything about? And I said,
exactly.
See, now this, I'm a historian. They're terrible on that. I know that because I'm a historian. So I just assume they're probably bad on things that I don't know anything about. Mm-hmm. And he basically said that I'm just never going to just go along with whatever the thing is without seriously investigating it. And I said, exactly right. I am not putting any kind of emoji in my social media. I'm not doing any of this. So he got the deep red pill. Where it did not, I don't know what his views on Ukraine were, but he was kind of implying that whatever the latest elite obsession is, he's not going for it.
I love it. I love it. I mean, that's obviously what we need a hell of a lot more for, especially when freaking mushroom clouds are the potential conclusion of you not, you know, processing and transferring that red pilling over to the latest propaganda. And it's really deeply concerning to me that that's where we're headed. I'm not sure if you've been following it super closely, but we have the 101st Airborne that was transferred to the Eastern Bloc region just on the border of Ukraine. They're doing drills. Looks like they could be preparing to potentially engage Russia inside of Ukraine. I mean, that it's fascinating. And I wanted to ask you about this. You know, obviously, you're old enough to have remembered the Cold War a little bit. I was a baby during it. But it seemed to me that it was pretty much unanimous that we all understood the reason that it was called the Cold War is because if that war went hot, we would all die.
Right.
I mean,
yeah, yeah. And there were summits between the Soviet premier and the American president regularly.
Right. Right.
They met now, with each
now
other.
Now we don't talk.
And sometimes, like at Reykjavik, they would fall apart.
Sure.
And other times, there would be real progress. And also, it came out a little bit more after he left office. But even at the time Reagan was in office, I think some people knew he was sincere about wanting to reduce nuclear armaments. He was genuinely sincere about that, and he wanted to be viewed in the history books as a peacemaker. Mm-hmm. And you just don't get that sense that that's what's motivating him. Of course, there aren't going to be any summits. There aren't going to be any talking. And if this Ukraine thing had been going on, you would at least have had 30 to 40% confidence that behind closed doors, they're probably talking.
Sure.
Whereas
you hope.
I've got 3 to 4% that they're talking. I hope there's a lot of bluster. And it's just crazy the extent to which people, I mean, they went along with the destruction of their lives for 2 years. Apparently, they're willing to go along with the destruction of their lives forever.
Right.
It is so important to some people to go along with whatever the powerful want. Whatever the powerful want, they're going to support. Because I keep mentioning my old friend, Jeff Leskovar. He has this theory. Because he would say, look, what the hell do climate change, COVID, and Ukraine have in common that everybody would basically have the same opinions on all three as a group? Like, why would that be? And he says, well, the answer is the elites all have this opinion on this, this opinion on this, this opinion on this. There are some people who are hardwired, maybe from, you know, years and maybe however many years ago when we were just hunter-gatherers and you didn't want to be left out in the cold and not part of the tribe, who just feel a compulsion to belong to the group. You know, like they're the ones who in high school made fun of you if you were a little bit different because you weren't part of the group and they find their security in the group. So the group says, wave this flag, whatever the hell flag you want me to wave, I'll wave it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll wave it to the point where the flag turns to ash and I'm dead. It is such a powerful, powerful motivator.
Yeah, well, it's the Michael Malice, you know, NPC phenomenon. These are non-player characters. They honestly don't seem to have any original individual thought processes. I mean, at least none that they publicize. It's like whatever they're doing, like as you described it, it went from, you know, you have the COVID mask to the Black Lives Matter fist to the vaccine emoji to the Ukraine flag emoji. And it's like it transitions effortlessly.
Isn't it interesting how quick that happened? Because these same people were all saying, I will never take any Trump vaccine.
Right.
And then it was, if you don't take the Trump vaccine, I hope you die.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. By the way, I forgot something I wanted to say. I have 2,200 plus episodes of the Tom Woods Show. And
yes, you do.
Tried to make some, some of them are current events, but I really have made an effort to make a lot of them evergreen, like on a lot of topics that libertarians should know something about, so that somebody joining years from now, the stream of episodes could just jump right in and still get some value out of it. But for 2 years, I did so many COVID-related episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And for a while, I thought, oh, this is too bad because no one's going to want to listen to these years down the road. But for somebody who wasn't around at the time or really aware of what was going on, that is actually a very interesting day-by-day recording of what it was like and what the craziness was like and the arguments they were making and how they were evolving and shifting and how we were trying to live our lives. So actually, I think it is evergreen. Even, you might think, that's all over and done. That's only good for people who were living at the time. I think we need to have a good day-by-day kind of a diary of what life was really like.
Yeah, I think it's so fresh that a lot of people don't want to think about it right now. But I hope, assuming we're fortunate enough to avoid nuclear holocaust, that 10 or 20 years from now, we have historians that go back through and really digest and process what we just experienced. Because I personally believe that it was the most dangerous period, assuming we make it out without all dying, the most dangerous period of groupthink and herd mentality and technocracy and a belief in authority and their infallibility, no matter how many times they overtly lied to us and how many things were provably wrong. It's astonishing. The period we have been and are living through.
I have to jump in here. I just clicked on comments because I don't know how this works. I've only used StreamYard a couple times.
Sure.
Somebody says, I wonder if Tom is still a Zionist. What a jerk. I have never been a Zionist. I have there's absolutely no thing I have ever said, no position I've taken ever to indicate I'm a Zionist.
I don't know where they got that.
I've never been a Zionist, ever. In fact, I wrote articles about why Christian Zionism is all wrong. I've quoted the popes, Pius X and others, talking about the conditions under which the Jewish people returned to their homeland, all of that stuff. There is absolutely no possible grounds on which you could accuse me of being a Zionist, unless the default is everybody's a Zionist unless I dig through and find. I mean, I've never, ever even remotely suggested that I might be a Zionist.
Tom,
so shut up and you owe me an apology.
I'll apologize for them. Don't take it personally, man.
Look, I don't care. Like, it's just, I'm never going to meet this person. But just like sometimes I love our people so much, but sometimes you run into that person. I had somebody speculate that I was part of a Jesuit conspiracy to take over the world. Now, first of all, I was flattered because if I'm part of something to take over the world, they must think I'm kind of important.
You're an elite.
But the whole argument was based on, well, let's see. So we've got evidence. First of all, his father graduated from a Jesuit high school in what was it, 1960. Okay, first of all, I never lived in Wisconsin. My father was born in 1951. So he would have been 9. He'd been a real prodigy graduating from high school. They had this whole thing and they had found all these other Tom Woodses. None of them were me.
Oh, and goodness.
All they proved was that whoever this Tom Woods was went to a Jesuit high school. I went to North Andover High School, a public school, where I was the valedictorian in 1990.
Or valedictorian, just like Joe Biden. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, was he?
No, he just lies about it.
I heard that John McCain, whatever it was, whatever grad thing he went to, was at like the bottom of his class.
Oh, yeah. Joe Biden.
They rise to the top, as Hayek says.
No, as they're on the campaign trail, they suddenly go from the bottom, quintile to the 99th percent. It's incredible how that works. Politicians lie. Breaking news. We got some nicer comments. In fact, we got like 60 comments, but I'm only going to pull up two of the nice ones. We got Top Lobster, my homie. He says, Tom Woods is the man. Would love to see you on No Way Jose's Anarchist Handbook series. I'd also love to help you create some merch for your loyal fan base. Shameless plug. He is actually the man behind all of my art. So I don't know.
Oh, I know. He gave me a shirt at the 2000th episode. I have a shirt commemorating that event. I erased it, but I have a whiteboard here just like a teacher in a classroom, because otherwise I can't use any app to keep track of my things to do. For some reason, I don't like it. I like it on a piece of paper. I want something where I can physically cross it out when I've done it.
Yes,
but then I have
a
piece of paper all over my house, and I hate that. So I got this whiteboard, and I have like short-term, medium-term, long-term goals written on there. And setting up a merch store for myself was on there for so long, I couldn't look at it anymore. Just had to take it away. Because the thing is, like, I don't want just products with my logo on them, because who wants that? I don't want a Tom Woods Show hat, you know? So I have to come up with something clever, and I don't have anything clever. You know, I know you think I'm just being falsely modest. I don't have anything t-shirt clever. That's my point. I don't have anything coffee mug clever.
Top is the guy.
You know, it's too much work.
Top is the guy. I'll give you his contact info. He's
all right. I could probably reach him if I needed to, but all right.
Yeah, of course. What else? Of course. And then we just got homie over at Libertarian Podcast Review says, congrats on the Tom Woods interview. I mean, we got a hell of a lot more, but I'll just keep it moving. No one else has sent money, so you don't get your comments read. Sorry, guys. That's how it works. Capitalism. Capitalism over here, folks. So I wanted to ask you if you, well, putting all my cards on the table once again, I'm of the opinion that Donald Trump was not a libertarian. I am still of the opinion that he was a quote-unquote outsider, in that he was not under the direct control of whoever, as you were saying earlier, who the hell runs everything, you know? Like, yeah. I don't think he is one of them. And I think that's why he was abused and basically cooed out of power. Even though I'm not a fan of Donald Trump, don't get it twisted. Right. I'm just saying, I think that he was an outsider. And my question for you is this. I think that Donald Trump's election signaled to the people, the powers that be, if you will, that the economic system, the governmental system, the cultural system, their entire mechanisms for control, their panopticon is so tenuous, it's so weak at this late stage that they can no longer risk their being an outsider candidate. And I wonder if they will ever allow us a genuine, even in the binary, you know, two-party system, if they will ever allow us to have a actual option to remedy this at the electoral avenue.
Okay, that's a good question. I mean, I know there are some people who say Donald Trump was controlled opposition, but
yes,
the fury against him is so out of control, irrational, that they're way overdoing it. I mean, he's not even in office anymore, and they're still, you know, and that doesn't make sense. If he were controlled opposition, they would be, you know, allocating their resources to something else by now.
You've evaluated so the same way I have.
And the thing is, you know, there are some things where he is different from them. You know, like his immigration views, although his policy in practice was more or less the status quo.
Sure.
So when you actually look at the way he governed in practice, with the exception of energy policy and maybe the Supreme Court, he's not wildly out of line with other national level politicians. So what could account for the hysteria, if not indeed, as you say, this concern that he can't be controlled?
Right.
They don't own him. You know, nobody owns him. That's the concern. Well, the thing is, though, I remember asking in the middle of Trump's term, what happens to the GOP post-Trump? Does it go swing back to Romney or does it stick Trumpian? And most of the people who answered me said it's probably going to go back to Romney.
Yeah, that ain't happening.
Institutional support for Trump. But to the contrary, I think a Romney has now no chance of winning the Republican nomination. None. It disappeared just like that.
Right.
That's an amazing, very, very interesting historical moment and achievement on Trump's part, is that there's no chance of a Jeb Bush being victorious now. So that means to me...
And he was a serious contender just 6 years ago.
Yes, he was. Oh, geez, and boy, did he brutally dispose of Jeb Bush. So it means to me that...
Low energy.
Who's left? If it's not Romney, then it's somebody in Trump's mold. It's a DeSantis...
Right.
It could even, in theory, could even be a Tucker Carlson, whom I suspect would not do it only because they ruin your life at this point. I mean,
of course.
They didn't do it to Romney because they knew Romney was a team player. But the Trump thing is also, it's partly Trump specifically, it's something about him as an individual that makes them crazy. But that was also meant as a lesson to anybody else who wants to be in his mold. Your life's going to be ruined and they're going to try to destroy you in every conceivable way. They're going to hurt your family. They're going to hurt your finances. They're going to hurt your reputation, your ability to get work, whatever. They're going to do all of it. I'm not sure. I think if I were Tucker Carlson, I would just want to stay on TV doing what I'm doing. Yeah. But I think that because the Romneys and the Bushes have been dispensed with, then I think the GOP becomes a channel for a Trump-style outsider. It doesn't have to be somebody who agrees with Trump on every issue, but it has to be an anti-Romney, anti-status quo outsider. I think there's still the prospect of that. As much as the GOP has frustrated me and, you know, I want to commit an atrocity and everything else, I think the unique circumstances of the present moment make a lot of new things possible.
Well, I certainly hope you're right. The reason I question whether or not there's any reason for electoral optimism is not that I don't believe that there's enough market demand or that the people haven't been woken up to the extent that they might support someone like that, but rather whether or not they will allow for a legitimate election, just to be blunt. And I know we're not allowed to talk about that, so I'm not even going to ask you to go deeper on it. Just things are so insane, and it's so obvious that they have realized, like, it's just obvious to me that they're very desperate. They're desperate to hold on to power. And I feel like Donald Trump set back their well-laid plans by 4 years. Everything's been expedited to a point of complete insanity. Well, I guess I'll ask you that. Do you think that we avoid World War III? Is that really their intention? Because it seems to me that they are doing everything in their power to bring it about, to force Russia into doing something rash, to justify an Article 5 violation, and God knows what happens from there, but it doesn't look good.
It doesn't, but yet I have to feel like there are enough sane people who cannot allow the world to be destroyed. I mean, what's the fun of being an elite on top of a pile of rubble?
Yeah, in a wasteland.
What's the fun? You know, all the people you want to lord it over are dead. What's the fun? You know, you can't rule over and brainwash anybody anymore. So, you know, maybe even the Russians might even say, all right, the Americans have obviously lost their minds, but somebody here has to prevent the destruction of the world, right, which I would prefer not to be remembered for.
Yeah. I actually said that a couple weeks ago.
Come on here and say the destruction of the earth is an absolute guarantee and it's going to happen. I don't believe that, and I don't even want to have that vibe.
Sure.
But I do remember my daughter, well, I have five of them, but the one who's 12, back in March, asking me if she thought there was the prospect of nuclear war. And at that time, thought never even crossed my mind. Mm. I said, no, neither side wants that. There's no way. Now I'm just kind of hoping she doesn't bring it up again.
Like, because I'm not going to lie to her this time if she asks me again.
I still have to sugarcoat it as much as possible. She is only 12.
Oh, no, no.
Having anxiety.
No, no,
I don't want having adult concerns when she's just 12.
No, at that age, I completely agree. There's a reason we don't tell our kids the highest level of concern truce sometimes. And I remember when I was young, I first learned about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and I lost nights of sleep. I was just like, this is unbelievable. Like, we have weaponry like this? Like, what are we doing?
I had this bizarre fixation as a teenager growing up in the 1980s with what nuclear war would be like.
Mm-hmm.
Even though in the 80s, it was much less likely than it was in the early 60s, let's say. But I was still interested in it. And there was this made-for-TV movie with Jason Robards called The Day After. Mm. And it was terrifying. And you were not, you know, parents, at least my parents did not want me to watch it. And they were pretty permissive when it came to what I pretty much watched what I wanted. But they didn't want me to watch this because they thought it would be traumatic. But I figured out a way. I eventually watched it.
Of course.
And it was fascinating and indeed terrifying. It was a terrifying movie. But then I only recently, like within the past year, did I find out about the British movie, kind of low budget movie called Threads. Do you ever see that?
No, don't know that one.
Oh, okay. Threads from the 1980s. Now, Threads spends more time not just on the immediate aftermath, but on like 6 months later, what's it like? A year later, 5 years later, 10 years later. What's the world like?
Mm-hmm.
And I found out about it because I was reading a book by Stephen Wilson, one of my favorite musicians, and he was listing movies that he's really been affected by. And he said that in Threads, he put in all caps, nothing good happens to anybody in this movie. And then he said, things become extremely, extremely grim, and then they become catastrophically worse. And I thought, I've got to see this.
I've always had an affinity for dystopic movies. I think it's funny.
I don't know why. I love them. I don't know why I'm attracted to them.
I've given a ton of thought to this. I have a thesis. See if you agree with it. It's because any dystopic tale, almost by its very nature, must include some sort of tyrannical government. So they have to highlight the downside of government. So from a libertarian perspective, it's just very appealing.
Well, I was about to say, well, except at the nuclear war thing. Yeah, okay, but who launched the missiles? It was
exactly
governments. So.
Yeah, and usually in the dystopic hellscape, there's always some sort of, you know, totalitarian panopticon that's able to regulate your speech and your online activity, all this stuff. So
There's this moment in Threads where people are, you know, they're all haggard and starving. And I don't know if it's a depot with food in it or what it is that they're trying to get access to. And the police are pushing them back and telling them to return to their homes. And one of them says something like, "What do you expect us to do?" Mm. And of course, everyone realizes at that moment, there is no answer to that question. Mm. And I think maybe one of the more terrifying parts of it, even though it may not be the most terrifying part of the movie, for some reason, it really got to me that there were news reports, you know, where electricity was still going, you know, talking about the catastrophic destruction, and then just simply with no fanfare saying, rescue efforts are unlikely. Rescue efforts are unlikely. Like, in other words, they've broken the back of the state, so we can't even provide our so-called services anymore. And so you're on your own. Rescue efforts are unlikely. Oh, man, that's terrifying.
Yeah. Well, World War III would be that for sure. So let's pray it doesn't happen. I do have one other subject I wanted to ask you about before we get there. I got another comment. Green Flash says, Tom Woods for president with Clinton as VP. You let me know when you want to run, Tom. I'm in.
Okay.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about entrepreneurialism because you don't know much about me, but I was an entrepreneur and I actually retired before I started the show. I didn't intend to retire. I was a mortgage broker. I thought I would do it probably until I was at least 50, but you know, the government had different plans for me. So I started this show and now this is a career path and who knew? But what has always concerned me, and I know you've talked about this in the past, is that libertarians broadly, I think, understand capitalism, economics, market forces, all sorts of things that are very important to become successful as an entrepreneur in really profound ways. And in my opinion, we have what I would consider, you know, one percenter type knowledge, information that differentiates us, that sets us apart from the competition, that should allow all of us, if utilized properly, to capitalize and become far more successful than the average person. And yet, it doesn't seem to transfer over as much as I would like it to. Why are more libertarians not utilizing the Austrian economic background, the understanding of business and marketing and all these other things that, from my vantage point, is kind of built into the libertarian framework?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Walter Block famously has this book, Defending the Undefendable. He has multiple volumes of it. And I'm trying to remember which one has it in there, but I think he's got the middleman as one of them. We have to cut out the middleman. Mm-hmm. Why was there ever a middleman if we just need to cut him out? You know, like, didn't mm-hmm. he serve some purpose?
Of course.
Or the advertiser. The advertiser is terrible. And usually they're left-wing arguments against the advertiser. The advertiser stokes desires that you wouldn't spontaneously have, you know, and that was the John Kenneth Galbraith criticism of advertising. But if that were true, that advertisers could just gin up any old desire they wanted, then nobody would ever need to do any marketing research to see what the public wants. They just have to come up with a really snazzy ad and it'll always work. So this was Rothbard's answer to Galbraith. So it does make me unhappy to see even some libertarians acting as if selling something is somehow shady or underhanded, or advertising is sort of wicked in some way, or marketing is bad. If libertarians aren't going to defend marketers, then no one's going to do it. Marketers themselves won't defend themselves because they've internalized the whole critique that all they're doing is shuffling papers around and they're not. No, the marketer is the guy who makes sure you know about that product.
Of course.
So if you create a product, you're not also a specialist in how to get it out before the public's attention. Those are two entirely different functions. Mm-hmm. And so you need somebody who specializes in that. And I keep using the example of that icy hot product that people use when they have arthritis and it's painful to move around. And that icy hot product just revolutionized things. It changed the lives of many, many older people who were saying, now I can walk around, I can run around sometimes with my grandchildren and enjoy my life again. Now, what good would the scientists who put icy hot together, what good would that have done if nobody found out about it? If it wasn't packaged for the public and publicized in a compelling way, it may as well not ever have been invented. So if we don't get that, we who understand how markets work, like we're the ones who defend quote unquote price gouging during an emergency because we're not illiterates. You know, we understand that at this very time when there's a sudden unexpected scarcity, if you interfere with prices, you're going to make everything worse. So we're willing to defend that. We won't defend marketers. We'll defend price gouging during a hurricane. And we won't.
Yeah.
How bad could marketers be, right?
Well, I've had listeners of mine who have unsubscribed when they realized that I used to be a mortgage broker. But the truth is, I was a private money mortgage broker. I had private investor capital. I had private borrowers. I didn't have access to the Fed window. I did it OG banking style, where I put a client together with a borrower and I'm the middleman that makes the magic happen to make sure that the investment is valid for my investor. It's so crazy to me that, like, just because we hate the current banking establishment, that they would then extrapolate that into, well, if you do any sort of lending, you're scum of the earth.
You're part of it.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Yeah. So I've found that there's not as much crossover as I think there should be. It's almost like theorizing about the capitalist system is more important than being in it.
Yeah.
And this is, unfortunately, one of the bad qualities of some libertarians. I remember Rothbard used to get so frustrated at how many libertarians were fascinated by science fiction, but bored to death by foreign policy. You know, it's nothing against science fiction, right? And nothing. I love science fiction. Some of my favorite books in the world are Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy series. Mm-hmm. Right? Okay, I love it. But I see his point. I think sometimes the reason we like science fiction is that it's a whole new world, a whole different world. You know, we can imagine a whole new world because with libertarianism, in a way, we're kind of imagining a different world that we create with new rules and so on and on. So I kind of get that. But yeah,
we believe in science fiction.
Libertarian academics who publish books that no one ever finds out about. They come on my show, they get a little publicity. No one ever finds out about. If these libertarian academics built up a mailing list and promoted their book to their mailing list, they would do vastly better. They would have much, much more successful, comfortable lives. And yet I can't get any of them to be interested in it. And so they just continue in obscurity when that's absolutely avoidable. They absolutely could avoid being in obscurity if they would just study different ways to build audiences, connect with the audiences, give things to the audience, heaven forbid, sell things occasionally to the audience.
Right.
So it's something I'm working on. I'm trying to make things better, but, you know, see how it goes.
No, I think that your work has been invaluable in that regard. And I think that you've been an inspiration to many people, including myself. And, you know, obviously I already had the entrepreneurial spirit, but, you know, to see someone like yourself or Dave Smith, Dave in particular was the one who really inspired me because I saw him on Joe Rogan like 6 years ago. And I was like, oh my God, it's me. It's me on Joe Rogan. Cause like, that's literally how I felt about it. And I realized suddenly that like, okay, there's a market for this. Like if Dave can do it, I can do it. It's kind of like seeing the first guy to run a sub 4 minute mile. It's like, oh, okay, it's possible. Like you can actually do this. It's incredible. And then all of a sudden there's a dozen people doing it. And I'm just so grateful for, you know, the people that kind of laid the groundwork to give me that case study, that proof that it's possible. Because I don't think I would have done it otherwise.
Example of somebody, a libertarian I've known since the first Ron Paul GOP presidential campaign, and that's John Bush. And John Bush is a great example of a libertarian entrepreneur who actually caters to libertarians. So he's not a libertarian entrepreneur who, you know, makes nails or something. He actually has products for libertarians. So whether it's homeschool training or how to use Bitcoin or stuff like that, or, you know, how to buy land in the country and build parallel structures, how to protect yourself financially during the Great Reset. And so he puts on these summits, sometimes in person and online, so hybrid, sometimes just online, and it does very, very well. I mean, he charges X for them and he does pretty well. And then also, it's a great way to build a mailing list because because he'll make the first 2 days of the summit free. And so you sign up to watch it, you get tremendous value from it. But now you're getting John's emails and John will pitch you the next thing and the next thing. That's how you do it. That's exactly how you do it. If you don't know what quote unquote product to create, create a summit. Just do that.
And that builds up
a mailing list for your next event, which builds up one for your next event. And then you go to somebody like me who has a mailing list and you say, I'll give you half the registration fee if you bring people to my summit. Okay, well, I'll send out an email about your summit then. If it's something that I believe in, if it's a summit about,
of course,
building the new socialist society, you can stick it, you know, where the sun don't shine. But if it's something that I believe in, then absolutely I'll do that. So then he gets people who've been following me. I went to the work to attract them and now he gets them. So these are very simple things. I mean, when I say simple, I don't mean there's no work involved. There's plenty of work. Simple, I mean the concepts are easy to grasp. You can, as soon as I explain this, you instantly understand what you need to do. So, you know, do it.
Yeah. No, it's so funny. I did a little 8-minute rant a couple of days ago about how I became a millionaire at 34. And literally the way I ended it was, you can do it. Do it. It's so funny because I think that's really the issue. It's not lack of knowledge. It's lack of go. Like, you have to go. And I hope shows like yours, shows like mine are inspiring more people to do that. We need people to do that. We're past time. I got one more super chat and I'll let you get out of here. Battle Elf says, hey, Liberty Lockdown, how should a high value elf prepare for the apocalypse? Well, you know, guns, bullets, land. Honestly, I think that real estate's a terrible investment at present. But I honestly, if you're looking to buy it for compound purposes, that's a totally different way to do things.
Right.
Apocalypse level, I don't think there's much to prepare for investment-wise. Like, you just have to, I mean, transition everything into weaponry and food.
Yeah. Let's hope it doesn't come to that.
Yeah. I don't honestly like thinking about investing for the apocalypse. Let's just hope we can do our best to avoid that.
But anyways, see, there's your summit. You know, if you're out of ideas, you could come up with something called investing for the apocalypse. Bring on some experts. There's your summit.
It's a catchy-ass title, brother. Do it. Do it, Battle Elf. Tom, go ahead and tell people where they can follow you and we'll hop out.
All right. Well, the best thing to do these days is, as usual, I have a free ebook, but this one is on national divorce, which is obviously necessary, but it's hard to get through to a lot of people on it. And there are some really compelling arguments for it. Chapter one of it is one of the best things I've ever done in all the years I've been around. So you can get it at nationaldivorce.com. It brings me pleasure to use that domain because I'm so glad I own that. Nationaldivorce.com.
That's a fantastic URL. Oh my goodness.
It's in the loving hands of Woods.
That's awesome. I'm so glad. It could not be in better hands.
Thank you. Now, that one I've said a few times. Usually you can buy a domain for $10 or less. Not this one.
No, I'm sure you had to pay a little.
This was a, quote, premium domain, but that's okay. I got it.
It was worthwhile. It was worth every penny because it's going to become increasingly popular as things kind of become more evidently screwed up.
You know, anyways, by the way, on this, just very quickly, the other one that ended up doing surprisingly well for me was I bought the domain aociswrong.com. But I bought it before. She wasn't always referred to as AOC. At the beginning, no one called her that.
Right.
I did AOC is wrong just because her name is so long. I'm not going to do Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez-is-wrong.com. So I just thought, well, I'll just take those three initials. And then to my amazement, everyone started calling her that. And I already own AOCiswrong.com.
Well, when she becomes president, that URL is going to be
Oh my gosh. Yeah, but when she becomes president, I will be in court like Alex Jones being sued for $1 billion for some trumped up charge.
Hey, I'll be there. I'll be your co-defendant. Anyways, thank you so much for joining me, Tom. It's been an honor. Really have been looking forward to this for a long time. I'm not sure if you're familiar, but I've had 10 people in my theme song that I shouted out when I first started the show 2 years ago, and you were one of them. It's just an amazing kind of capstone to my journey to have now had all of them on except for Eric July, who I do have his phone number, but I refuse to use it for guest purposes. I'm sure I'll get him eventually. He's very busy.
I mean, I would give him another month to emerge from the overwhelm from his guy.
Exactly.
I can't even get, but I'll tell you what's the last thing. I was able to finally get Eric on text because when he succeeded really well, I sent him and his wife a gift basket from not Omaha, but another big steak company.
Sure.
So he got a big box full of steaks as a congratulatory gift. So then he texted me and said, dude, thank you for the steaks. I said, are you going to come on my show?
Oh, see, you played it right. I got to send him some steaks then.
Yeah, send him some steaks. That'll text you. So anyway, no, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Hopefully we can do it again down the line.
All right, folks, that'll do it. If you're hearing this in time, there are still a couple of days left to watch The Real Anthony Fauci, the RFK documentary. They just released part two. It's a two-parter, and it's just fantastic. So check it out, tomwoods.com/Fauci. But hurry up, because by, I think, November 1st, I think that might be the last day of the free viewing period. And it is very, very much worth seeing. And it's worth even having people over to watch, a whole bunch of people, and then you can talk about it. So anyway, tomwoods.com/Fauci is the link for that. And I'll see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.